So, with that extraordinary introduction to the Vedic material, we will now turn to the dynamics of Hindu rituals. It is therefore my tremendous honor to introduce Prelay Kanungo, visiting us from Leiden University, who will take us to the modern period. Prelay, please.
Well, first of all, I thank Professor Cheng for inviting me. Well, in a way, taking the risk of inviting a novice who doesn't really know China very well, but it's a conference of the scholars on China. But perhaps, you know, she thought that I would give some Indian perspective. And again, it's a big challenge to be the second speaker, right, after Professor Malamud. So I am inviting all risks, and well, I love taking risks. This is on text, context, and practice, the changing dynamics of Hindu rituals. Well, what I intend to do here is, first I briefly introduce the India-China connection, civilizational as well as contemporary. Well, it's quite huge, but I just give a brief introduction. Second, broadly outline the contour of Hindu rituals with some illustrations. Third, I would like to refer to, I dumped what I did. After listening to you yesterday, I reworked on my presentation to fit into this, you know, conference, the theme of the conference. So I'll very briefly respond to certain questions raised yesterday. And finally, which is my specialization, you know, I'll talk about politics of rituals. So this is the broad kind of outline of my presentation. Well, this is the civilizational connection. From Utaishan to Wuhan. Here Utaishan, the hall of Sakyamuni, well built in 68, right? So the relationship goes back, you know, this is civilizational connection. And now, last fortnight or, you know, I forget, twice, the Prime Minister Modi and Xi Jinping met at Wuhan. It's a kind of informal dialogue. Informal talk. I bring in contemporary and civilizational together, primarily because people today talk of that India and China are the emerging nations. I don't really subscribe to this emerging nations, right? So when the nationhood was not there, right, at that time, these are two great civilizations. So I think this is very important to dispel this very idea of emerging. Well, there was a decline. Maybe they're returning to the contemporary in a big bang. That's another story. But we must recognize the civilizational dimension of both these countries. And just, you know, because I'll just very briefly touch this. So I just went to a temple. I went to Taishan, of course. Then this is the journey where the temple in Sichuan. There, this is a temple called Literary Star. And you can see that, you know, the youngsters, the college-going, you know, youngsters are coming and, you know, putting an incense or candle. And of course, there are other ways of propitiating the god. But I think you can also, at that temple, I see there's, you know, an elephant. That, in a way, reminded me of Lord Ganesha. If you just look at this elephant, the very structure. So I am just thinking, you know, Ganesha in India, in the Hindu tradition, is also, you know, he has many qualities, but one of the qualities that he represents wisdom or Saraswati. So you have gods and goddesses in Hindu pantheon who represent, you know, knowledge, wisdom. I think that is, I see that kind of connection in the Chinese temples. Well, this is another here myself, right? I am taking blessings from the Taoist leader of Sichuan, you know, from Qingchen Shan Mountain, the holy shrine, holy dham, I would say, in Hindu tradition. That is, Utaishan is a dham, and also this is another dham. One is the Buddhist dham, this is the Taoist dham. So in this dham, you know, the way I sit, and the way the religious leader is actually giving me blessings. This is what I call it, It's a kind of Sindhian practice. So this is, you know, this practice is both in China and India. So, you know, my professor Tan Chung was talking of this idea of Sindhya, right, and greatly propagating this kind of idea. And I think this is an interesting practice where I feel comfortably at home with the religious leader, and she's also blessing without any kind of, though we don't speak each other's language, but we connected. Well, this is another, this is coming to the contemporary connection. Cult worship in China and India. So Mao, Chairman Mao is now being offered, right? All this kind of, you can see that, you know, I think this is an old photograph in 90s when people are actually, there are many, I had not visited this temple, right? But I understand and I talk to people, and the Chairman Mao is worshipped. So he's no more just the personality cult it was developed, you know, but now it's actually a godly figure in rural China in some parts. And here you find the present Prime Minister of India, Modi, you know, there's also a temple built in his honor. So what, so the strong leader has the kind of, you know, has the power he amasses, right? And people feel that, you know, like, you know, well, there is no God on earth, right? But they, you know, they can depend for their welfare, right? You know, and they can pay their obeisance, you know, later and by respecting. Well, China and India are so close, yet so different. While China is passionate about harmony, India lives with chaos. While China is obsessed with unity and homogeneity, India cannot survive without recognizing and celebrating plurality and diversity. In fact, India's motto, that's why, is unity in diversity. If India pushes too much of unity, then India is likely to disintegrate. While China's empire-building experiment was a great success, India's empire-building experiment was intermittent and not really successful, very short-lived. So India has Mauryan Empire, Gupta Empire, couple of empires, but they really didn't live long. India is multi-religious, but Hinduism is overwhelming with 80% of followers. Yet the number of Muslims and Christians is significant. This is very important because India has the second largest Muslim population in the world, close to 180-190 million. And similarly, India's Christian population is more than Australia's population. So let the number not really, or the percentage should not really mislead, right? This is very important. And they also play an important role, significant influences in polity, society, and economy. Unlike other world religions, Hinduism doesn't have a single text. It's very important. A single God, a single church. That is the uniqueness of Hinduism. And the difference again, that while China is reluctant, in fact struggling even to recognize religion, religion is all pervasive in India. So while looking at the similarities, right, Chinese government also understand, Chinese state understand that, you know, religion is very important, but they're reluctant at this stage. The second part, now talk of rituals. Well, I think enough has been said, but certain things I would repeat a little. Well, Hinduism doesn't grant supreme importance to a single scripture. We listened about Vedas, but I agree that, you know, Veda has two. The earlier Vedas are called Shrutis. The latter Vedas are called Smritis. And Smritis are less authoritative, because they are memorized. They are not directly coming from God to the sages. So Vedas, of course, has the exalted status, but everybody doesn't really subscribe to the Vedas. Moreover, scriptures by themselves are never sufficient, even necessary in religious life. There are scriptures, but you can be a good Hindu, right? A devout Hindu without following any scriptures. So there are Shastras, as mentioned by Professor Malmuth, but there are also Vyavahar. So religion has these two dimensions, textual, non-textual, or practical, right? So practice is more important. So what I see is that lived Hinduism or Hinduism in practice scores over textual Hinduism. Well, rituals are also contextual, local, regional, national, and global. And all these layers are important. In fact, local contexts are very strong. And people can forget about national and others, right? And they just celebrate the local context. So context, text, of course, is important. But context, perhaps, in many cases, more important when most of the population are not literate. They don't really relate to the kind of text. So they go by the context and practice. There are various types. Samskara was mentioned here. I'm not going to that. As mentioned again, I repeat that for Hindus, ritual is a duty or dharma. Dharma can be religion, dharma can be righteousness, dharma can be duty. As mentioned by Professor Malmuth, it's duty. Actually, it's duty in case of ritual. So in Sanskrit terms, you have yajna, sacrifice rituals, utsava, festivals, tirthayatra, pilgrimage, seva, worship. Seva is also a kind of ritual. Vrata is vow. Raj Tilak, coronation. Coronation is very important in the Indian context, particularly when talking of ritual politics. Ashwamedha, victory, winning the territory. So, yes, you know, there was a mention of the territory, how territory is really important as a ritual. So, Ashwamedha in the Vedic period, latter Vedic period, and today, of course, you have different kind of, you know, territorial rituals. I'll come to that. Well, looking at different characters, features of the rituals are on the move. Rituals constantly great, reconfigured, transformed, reinvented. So they're never static. Well, they're not really losing the core element. They retain the core element, but they can be, you know, redesigned depending on the context. Rituals are undergoing rapid transformation, particularly in the contemporary context of migration, urbanization, and globalization. So rural and urban, when there, you know, Hindus come from rural part to urban part, you know, you find the rituals do change because, you know, they have to, survive in a different context. So they have to adapt the new situation and the context. Well, Hindu self, you know, there is again a lot of references that Hindu selves differ again in different contexts because Hinduism is eclectic. Hinduism is adaptive. Hinduism is innovative. So different social groups attempt to create different kinds of what you call cultural heritage, retain that kind of heritage in multiple ways. There is no single way of, in a way there is less uniformity or standardization. There have been attempts to standardize, but this standardization really doesn't work, looking at the diversity and plurality of Hinduism. So rituals enable social agents to imagine historical and social continuity and rootedness while simultaneously responding to and legitimizing change. Rituals are performative and theatrical, more theatrical in Hindu rituals, I would say. Rituals represent different genres, mainstream and marginal. So while we are talking of Shastric, you know, rituals, as mentioned, they are important, but in the margins today, there are many Hindus. You know, say, for instance, I'd give you example, the tribals, or, you know, we call tribals, but indigenous population, or the Adivasis. right? They have very strong rituals rooted in their kind of context. And they do, you know, you talk about the sacrifice. You know, perhaps the sacrifice you are questioning, this sacrifice is very different. Sometimes they used to sacrifice animals and other kinds of, you know, sacrifice by the indigenous communities. Then today, what we see is a kind of de-ritualization. That is, again, by the Hindu leaders. New Age Hinduism is not emphasizing on rituals, but going away from rituals, and they're saying that what we represent is kind of spiritualism. So spiritualism is replacing religion, Hinduism, Hindu religion, right? Because rituals are dispensed with, right, by these New Age Hindu gurus and others in different contexts, because that's more attractive proposition today and appealing to a particular class, the mobile class and so on. Well, just reflect on certain, because this god called Jagannath, located in Puri, my home state, that's why I brought in, because this god, you look at the, you know, the design of this. This is an indigenous god, you know, it's a tribal god. You can look at the shape, right? It's unfinished, right? And various stories, but you can see that all life cycles, you know, everything from morning to night, right? Every hour, rituals are performed in this temple. What kind of breakfast? What kind of lunch? What would be the drink? You know, God will sleep, take a nap in the afternoon, right? So if you look at the rituals of this temple, that's give you entirely the rituals of the everyday rituals of Hindus, right? But God is a privileged being, right? So he had this kind of food, elaborate food, which common man doesn't get, but he, all the rituals are performed in the temple. Then this Rath Yatra is very important, that you can see that it's a God's day out, but this is again unique, that God is moving out of temple to meet people, to greet people. Because those who cannot have a glimpse of God inside the temple, many were denied to enter the temple, they have now a chance to meet the God. Right? So you can see that this is a ritual, that the king becomes a sweeper. So before the Lord, you know, goes out, he has to sweep the floor. So this is also again a tradition that Hinduism is saying that, look, you are not, the king has to submit to the God. So this is again very important. Well, I come to the public spectacle and political theater. This is the Ganges, bank of the Ganges. You can see the performative part of these rituals. Every evening it becomes a huge spectacle. Yes. And you can see Prime Minister Modi. I brought him there because he represented the parliamentary constituency of Banaras. So Banaras is the holy city of Hindus, located on the banks of the Ganges. And you can see that it is just a spectacle, but with Modi, Prime Minister Modi, the Japanese Prime Minister is standing. So Japanese Prime Minister is the guest who is also performing this aarti, the puja, the worship of the river. So you can see the huge spectacle. So he represents this political constituency. And when he contested from the parliamentary constituency, he said, you know, Ganga Mane Bulaya Hai. That means I was called by the river Ganges. River Ganges is the mother. So the call of the mother, I have come to represent the people. So you can see that how rituals could be used for a kind of, you know, public or political goal. Well, he won hands down, right? And well, some comments very quickly, that Hindu rituals and Liji rituals were the prescribed. Few of the things, you know, I just took down yesterday. You know, there's a Michael Ng has suggested that, you know, like this pre-civilized and civilized. I wanted to raise this question, that that may be there in the Liji, But in Hindu, as I understand, Professor Malmudur, correct me, that there is no, it seems that, you know, the relation, the communication, the moment the communication between human being and God started, at that time human being became civilized. It's not that, you know, like that, you know, somebody will come with a text and make you civilized. So invention of fire, which is, fire is the means of communication between human world and the, you know, and the God. So I think that is one part. Music of no sound, I contest. In Hindu religion, it is the sound of music. Yes, because everywhere, I mean, all the periods of history you see, or the Bhakti period, any period, music is very, very important. Even if there is a moment of silence, somebody yesterday was talking of rhythm, right? Rhythm and music. So if you are silently, if you are silent, again also, you know, that sense of music remains, right? And after all, it is claimed that the creation began, the universe began with the powerful sound of Om. So Om is the beginning of this universe. So sound is very important. Moments of silence, quiet meditation is of course important, right? But death rituals, as the chair mentioned yesterday, that, like Confucian prescription, as I understood you correctly, if at all, are merely, you know, not just merely symbolic, but substantial. The son takes over the role of the deceased father. So that's also, again, I think, important in the, you know, in the, both the context. Well, wedding rituals, there are some, Professor Yao actually started with, you know, he encouraged me to really rework my presentation, right? Because, you know, he started with, you know, a kind of exciting note. So I am questioning, you know, well, there is law, constitution, this is happening, but outside the constitution, beyond the constitution, there is also another world of wedding, which I took this photograph on the great wall, right? So of China. So there is also celebration. This is also ritual, I understand, right? It's outside the domain of the state. And this is this ritual that, which is again legal, because we took some points, I can't respond everything, that the seven, you know, kind of circles you take around the fire. This is also very much legal here in the Hindu context, okay? I stop here. This is new territory, again. You can see that how Indian map and with Bharat Mata, right? So you find that way the nationalism is reconstructed in the present context, and there's a temple for this Bharat Mata. Okay, I just stop here. Then I'm last, ritualizing war and violence. This is called Shastra Puja. You know, like you can see that Prime Minister Modi is, you know, worshipping guns, right? So this is again a ritual in the present context. This is militant Hinduism and ritual politics. This is Mumbai. Namaz going on, and the militant Shiv Sena is saying that why the Muslims are actually, you know, praying on the street. So then if they do it, we will do aarti or puja on the street. So they started, so you get a competitive kind of, you know, communal politics happening there. So this is the last, new forms, new meaning, and Hindu nationalist identity. Today India is governed by Hindu nationalism, and you can see that the Rakhi, this is Raksha Bandhan. This is the original is this, that sister ties this thread, sacred thread, around the wrist of her brother seeking protection. That is the old story. But now you can see the male members of this RSS, they are tying Rakhis with each other. Right? So it's a new interpretation of ritual. Okay? I stop it there. Thank you so much.